of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a result of being concerned about what's taking place. That came, by the way, over the objection of the Pentagon during that time. In 1986, I authored the legislation to establish the Special Operations Command. Once again, I would point out over the objections of the Pentagon, because I felt it was important to enable us to be able to respond to the emerging threats. I wrote and I spoke about the subject on numerous occasions, convinced that the threat was growing, it was becoming more organized, less sporadic, and when coupled with access to weapons of mass destruction, likely to pose an existential threat to the world. I carried these convictions to the Pentagon when President Clinton asked me to serve as the Secretary of Defense. I found that he not only shared my views, but he was prepared to support efforts to counter these threats with dollars, with deeds, as well as with his presidential words. In my experience, the threat of international terrorism remained a top priority for all members of his national security team throughout the years I served at the Pentagon. In my written statement, I outlined some of the major initiatives that I had the department undertake between January of 97 and 2001. They included enhancing force protection, support for covert and special operations activity, designating and organizing the National Guard to serve as the first responders in the wake of attacks against our cities, organizing a joint task force for civil support to assist the cities and states against terrorist attacks that might take place, helping to train 100 major cities in consequence management against terrorist attacks, engaging in personal diplomacy and public appearances to alert the American people to the threat posed by anthrax, ricin, VX, and radiological materials, the danger of them falling into the hands of terrorist groups. These initiatives were undertaken as the department was engaged in waging war in Kosovo. We attacked Saddam Hussein in Operation Desert Fox, as we destroyed a suspected WMD site in Sudan, as we cope with the dangers of cyber attacks against our critical infrastructure, including the unknown consequences of a critical massive cyber failure that was then known as Y2K. I believe that we devoted some $3 to $4 billion in defense spending at that time to cope with that for fear that the terrorists would try to exploit that millennium turnover. We launched an attack upon al-Qaeda's training camp in Afghanistan, as has been discussed earlier today. We continued efforts to capture or kill Osama bin Laden after discovering his role in the bombing of the U.S. Embassies in Africa and then later with the USS Cole. And we developed new intelligence gathering capabilities that could be directed against Osama bin Laden and others, as, again, you have discussed here earlier this morning. In addition, the department also worked closely with the CIA, the FBI, and other agencies. And as a result, I believe we were able to thwart a number of terrorist activities directed here against Americans and abroad. I know the Commission is anxious to explore more specifically what happened or did not happen at the Defense Department. But I'd like to try and paint, in the few moments that I have, at least a broader perspective as well. I think all of us who have held the public trust have to be accountable for what we did or did not do during our careers in the public service and holding the public trust. But I want to put it in the perspective as a former member of the Senate and a former member of the House of Representatives as well, because I think as the Commission may find fault, indeed that's all, in all probability, that might be the goal of the Commission. I don't think so, but I hope you'll find the fault lines as well in our society as a whole. And if you just permit me 4 or 5 minutes to outline some of the challenges I think that all of us face, certainly while I was in the Senate, also at the Department of Defense. I point out that on many occasions the administration was able to secure the cooperation of Congress in the pursuit of its goals. There were a number of other occasions in which we did not. For example, some in Congress, the media, and the policy community accused those of us who were focused on the terrorist threat of being alarmist, of exaggerating the threat in order to boost our budgets. And countering this threat of terrorism was, quote, the latest gravy train, according to one expert who was quoted in U.S. News and World Report. And the belief that we were somehow indulging in a cynical hyperbole, I think, resulted in a number of legislative reactions. There were tens of millions of dollars cut out of the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, the so-called Nunn-Lugar Program, which I believe was one of the most important programs we could have passed. And that was to help reduce the accumulation of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear materials, and others in the possession of the former Soviet Union. Tens of millions of dollars were cut from that program. I think posing a greater risk to us. We had to spend a significant amount of time trying to lobby to restore funds in that regard. Congress blocked the cooperation with countries whose support was critical to counterterrorism efforts, such as banning military cooperation with Indonesia, by way of example, the world's largest Muslim country that is a key battleground in the campaign against Islamic extremists, and banning any meaningful cooperation with Pakistan, the frontline state in the global war on terrorism. There were reasons for this, but nonetheless, that was the reality. We had a program called IMET, which was designed to put our military into contact with the militaries of other countries to help educate them in the way that a civilized country and a democracy is able to subordinate the military to civilian rule and to pursue democratic values. Well, the program was terminated based on activities that took place in that country and elsewhere. We had congressional committees who rejected requests for legislative authority to the department to provide certain support to domestic activity or agencies to prevent or respond to terrorist actions in the United States. It was this, with this in mind, that I try to combat this complacency and cynicism that I helped to create, not to create, but I filled the membership of a commission that was led by former Senators Rubman and Hart, including the vice chairman of this commission, former Speaker Gingrich, along with retired senior military commanders and others. In releasing the commission's first report long before September 11, Vice Chairman Hamilton said the state of the fundamental issue. He said, "What comes across to me in this report more than any other single fact is that the commission believes that Americans are going to be less secure than they believe themselves to be. And so I think what we're trying to say in this report is that we've lived in a very secure time. We're very fortunate for that, but we're going to be confronted with a lot of challenges to our national security that Americans do not believe we're going to be subject to. And that's really what comes out of this report for me more than any other single thing." Well, I'll tell you, his remarks really resonated with me because I recall at my very first press conference as Secretary of Defense back in 1997, I was asked, "Mr. Secretary, what is your greatest concern as you look toward the future?" And I'd like to just read my response. "My greatest concern is that we're able to persuade the American people that having a viable, sustainable national security policy is important, even when there's no clearly identifiable enemy on the horizon. We still live in a very dangerous, disorderly world, and in many cases we face dangers that are comparable to those we faced in the past, namely, the proliferation of missile technology, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and the spread of terrorism." I believe that we have been complacent as a society. I think that we have failed to fully comprehend the gathering storm. Even now, after September 11th, I think it's far from clear that our society truly understands the gravity of the threat that we face, or is yet willing to do what I believe is going to be necessary to counter it. Even after September 11th, after the anthrax and the ricin attacks in the United States, I remain concerned that the controversy over not finding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction will lead to the erroneous assumption that all this talk about the dangers of WMD is just another exercise in the cynical exploitation of fear. And after all, it's commonly noted, it was noted here again this morning, the no attacks since September 11th. I think this is a dangerous delusion. The enemy is not only coming, he has been here. He will continue to try to examine our weaknesses and exploit the crevices in our security and destroy our way of living as well as our lives. Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude here. I think you can deduce from my written statement, I believe that the Clinton administration, far more than any previous administration prior to September 11th, understood that the threat that terrorism poses to our country. I think it took far greater and more comprehensive action to counter it than previous administrations did by virtue of the growing threat. But in spite of all of this, the United States was hit in a devastating way. Even today, with a global war on terrorism being waged, I believe we need to do far more to prevent the spread of virulent Islamic extremism and to prevent terrorism from reaching our shores. I don't pretend to hold the keys to the kingdom of wisdom and what needs to be done in the future. But I think, as I said before, we all must stand accountable for our actions. It's my hope that the commission, again, will focus on the fault lines that run through our democratic system as we struggle to cope with the challenges of unprecedented proportions. I've outlined just a couple of items which I think should be considered for the future. I think we have to develop an in-depth public discussion among our citizens as well as among elected officials regarding the compromises on privacy that we're willing to accept in order to remain free and safe. The current debate over access to personal data for aviation security purposes, I don't think is encouraging. We have to elevate the public discussion on these matters and do our best to remove from them electoral manipulation, at least until we truly understand the issues and choices. We have to reconcile the role of technology that's going to play in our lives for good and ill, and try to maintain and ensure that it remains our master and not we don't remain its slave. I don't think it's going to be an easy balance to strike, but I think it has to be done. I think we have to consider establishing a domestic intelligence organization distinct from law enforcement and subject to appropriate control and regulation and oversight. I think we have to secure and eliminate on an accelerated basis fissile nuclear materials and chemical and biological weapon agents that pose a risk of diversion. This is going to require a much more cooperative relationship with Russia than we currently have. And I think we have to re-energize America's engagement in the Middle East. I believe that the road to peace in the Middle East runs through Baghdad, then success in Baghdad may very well run through Jerusalem. The unabated violence can only serve, in my judgment, to remain a breeding ground for even more savagery and nihilism in the future, and this effort should not await the counting of ballots in November. And finally, I think we need to persuade the free people of the world that the war on terror cannot be waged by America alone. As recent events demonstrate, religious extremists and fanatics don't recognize geographical boundaries. There are no rear lines. There are no pockets of tranquility. There are no safe harbors for innocent civilians. Every one of us is on the front lines today. A virus or a bomb, born in a distant laboratory or a factory, is but a plane ride away from any place on this planet. So it's time for sober reflection and the charting of a responsible course of action. And to the extent I can contribute to this, Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to answer your questions.
Secretary, thank you very much for a very articulate statement.
Former Secretary of Defense William Cohen, former Senator from Maine, and the first member of the commission to ask questions will be Fred Fielding, who was in the White House Counsel's office in the Nixon administration.
The commission and the staff in preparing this, and your very fulsome prepared testimony as well as your remarks this morning. I'd also like to express my personal high regard for you and for all the years of public service that you've given to this nation. Thank you. We, of course, have a mission to fulfill, and one of the things that we obviously have to figure out is what happened on 9/11. But equally important to our mission is to figure out the other factors that may have contributed to the situation we found at 9/11. And obviously, again, one of those is the development of our counterterrorism strategy. And, of course, we're going to pick your brain and again today as far as the aspects of the military fed into that. And my colleagues have a lot of questions, so I'll try to watch that little ball as much as anybody. But under Presidential Directive 62, the military, of course, and the Defense Department didn't have the leading role in counterterrorism efforts during your tenure. And yet, ironically, we've heard a lot of testimony and a lot of commentary that the military was being criticized for being reluctant to use its forces and to conduct military operations against al-Qaeda and bin Laden. As a matter of fact, in Richard Clark's now very famous book, he says, the White House wanted action. The senior military did not, and made it almost impossible for the president to overcome their objections. And I know that you've seen other commentary like that, that the primary limitation that's often cited is that for each decision for using military force, there was this lack of actionable intelligence. And we've heard about it today, and we've heard about it a lot. And our understanding of that is what was stated earlier, that at a specific time you couldn't anticipate where the location of bin Laden or his key followers might be, so that it could be sufficiently determined that it was worthwhile to launch military reaction to it. After August 20th of 98, there were at least three opportunities of which we've been privy to use force against bin Laden. And however, in each case, it was determined that there wasn't actionable intelligence. I guess the first question I'd like to say is, whose call is that? I mean, how does that decision become a factor and a determinative factor? And in addition to that, if I could, given that you had setbacks in using force, what was your assessment of the existing capabilities at that time of the CIA? The existing capabilities. To obtain what would be required as actionable intelligence, and to the extent that you found them deficient, what steps did you take to supplement and to put into action things that the Defense Department could do to beef up that capability?
On the second part, Mr. Fielding, I think that Senator Kerry and others would tell you that over the years, one of the identifiable deficiencies within our intelligence collection capability is the absence of good human, that we have over the years tended to oscillate between focusing on technical capabilities with our satellite gathering technologies as opposed to developing human intelligence. With the fall of the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, that becomes a much more challenging objective to get good human intelligence in areas that are governed by tribal leaders, where an individual perhaps can detect who is a remote cousin the minute they show up within 200 yards. So penetrating societies such as that become even more problematic in terms of developing good human intelligence. And then you're called upon to try and develop assets on the ground. Well, then the question is, who do you trust, and how can you trust them, and based on what evidence in the past that they have been credible? All of that goes into an analysis by the CIA, working with other intelligence agencies. Secretary Powell talked about INR. We have DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. But essentially, we turn to the DCI to say, do we have good intelligence? We review the PDB, has been discussed earlier today. We sit down at the cabinet-level meetings with the president and or with the National Security Advisor and his team, and say, is this good enough intelligence to warrant taking action? And each case has to be looked at in that regard. Now, you mentioned August of 98. Frankly, it was following the bombing of the embassies in East Africa that the antenna were really up. We were collecting at a level that I saw, it was unprecedented in terms of the amount of information coming in, pointing to bin Laden, and then getting the information there would be a gathering of terrorists in Afghanistan. After reviewing all that information, the determination was made this was a target certainly that we should attack, that plus the so-called pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. But it was that kind of a process whereby, what do we have? Do we have to be certain? The answer is no. Do you have to be pretty sure? I think that the answer is yes, if you're going to be killing a lot of people. We're prepared to engage in collateral damage if the target that we're after is certainly important. But all those factors are into a decision. But having, quote, actionable intelligence mean reliable and the basis of that reliability. Single source information, usually, I think George Tenet will tell you, not good enough. Maybe if they've got a single source that is truly reliable, they've had them in the past, that might be under the circumstances. But it all depends upon the quality of the people you've got on the ground, coupled with whatever you can put up in the air to locate certain targets.
But who makes that final decision? Who makes
President
that
of the United
call?
States. President of the United States makes the final decision. We make recommendations. We, as the national security team, would sit down, examine it, and then come to a consensus if we could. If we couldn't, frankly, we would go to the president with our individual recommendations, but most of the time we were able to reach a consensus. And then the president weighs what has been recommended to him to act or not to act and then makes the decision.
Now, just following up again on my earlier line of questioning, though, did you do anything or were there any steps available that you thought were worth taking to augment the CIA's capabilities for collecting intelligence?
We worked with the CIA. There were some joint efforts as such to reinforce the CIA. We had a cooperative program in terms of the unmanned aerial vehicles, the UAVs. There was some controversy over that as well, I might add. But trying to find him was certainly a joint enterprise. in terms of technical capability. Did we have people on the ground in Afghanistan? The answer was we did not, for the most part.
Was that just not really a viable, realistic option?
Well, again, looking at Afghanistan, looking at the history of that country, look at the power and the the relationship of the tribes in the region. The notion that we could put, quote, special forces in that region that would go undetected or uncompromised, I think was pretty remote. Was it possible? You could say it was possible. Was it advisable? We didn't think so at the time, and I think in reflection, we still don't think that was a viable option.
I'd like to ask your opinion because we have to evaluate the three incidents, and we've heard a lot of testimony and a lot of writings that particular second event that I made reference to, I think it was in February of 99, the hunting camp with the UAE,
right.
Hunting camp, that was the lost opportunity.
Well, you know, there were, as I recall, there were at least three instances in which the initial intelligence take, as they called it, that we think we have him. And what we would then do is, quote, spin up the military at that point, namely our ability to target that particular area with the thought of taking that individual or group of people out. There were three instances. Each time munitions and the people were spun up, they were called off because the word came back, we're not sure. We're not quite sure. In one instance, there was an identification that somehow we had bin Laden in our sights. Turned out it was a sheikh from UAE. There was another consideration of shooting down an aircraft that might be carrying a bin Laden should he try to escape. That also proved to be reversed by the intelligence community, saying we don't think we have him. So there were three occasions following the attack on the camps in Sudan, but in each and every one of those occasions, it came back on a second look saying, we don't think we've got enough here to recommend to the president that we should take military action. And that came from the intelligence community through the National Security Advisor, and we all sat and made a collective judgment, okay, under the circumstances, we don't fire.
Now, if you could assist us, if I can take you back to the August 20th attack and response attack. After that happened, there was criticism about the pharmaceutical plant.
Right.
And there was also criticism in general about trigger happy and this sort of thing. And recalling that negative reaction, does that criticism affect the planning and use of military force in defending the United States in this context?
I'm glad you asked that question, Mr. Fiolini, because it's something that I have wanted to talk about for some time. In terms of the kind of poisonous atmosphere that existed then, that continues to exist today, you're going to discuss Mr. Clark's book with him tomorrow, but all of the accusations, questioning motives, and calculations. During that time, when the attack was launched in Afghanistan and Sudan, there was a movie out called Wag the Dog. There were critics of the Clinton administration that attacked the president, saying this was an effort on his part to divert attention from his personal difficulties. I'd like to say, for the record, under no circumstances did President Clinton ever call upon the military and use that military in order to serve a political purpose. When I took the office, I had a very clear understanding with the president, and he was very clear with me. Under no circumstances would I ever be called upon to exercise any kind of partisan relationship, would participate in no politics, and would never allow the military to be used for a political purpose. President Clinton was true to his word. He never called upon us to do that. It was strictly on the merits. Now, that accusation surfaced again. And it was something of concern to me. I'll take just a few moments to express it. In that winter, in December of 1998, we decided to attack Saddam Hussein. It was called Operation Desert Fox. It was a four-day operation in which we launched a number of attacks upon his weapons of mass destruction sites, his missile production facilities, and killing a number of Republican guards and others. I got a call the day that that operation was launched. I received a call from Speaker Gingrich and then-to-be Speaker Livingston, asking me to come up to Capitol Hill. They said the House was in an uproar. There was a rage boiling in the House of Representatives. This clearly had to be politically inspired. I was eager to go up to the Hill. I had not been in the House of Representatives for 20 years. And I walked that evening into the well of the House of Representatives. There were almost 400 people there that night, maybe more, to a closed session of Congress. And I spoke for 3 hours, assuring every single member that the reason we attacked Saddam Hussein was because of his noncompliance with the Security Council resolution, that at no time did the President of the United States ever seek to use that military strike in order to avoid or divert attention from the impeachment process. I was prepared at that time and today to say I put my entire public career on the line to say that the President always acted specifically upon the recommendation of those of us who held the positions of responsibility to take military action, and at no time did he ever try to use it or manipulate it to serve his personal ends. And I think it's important that that be clear, because that wag the dog cynicism that was so virulent there, I'm afraid it's coming back again. And I think we got to do everything we can to stop engaging in the kind of self-flagellation and criticism and challenging of motives of our respective presidents.
Thank you. That also is the conclusion of the staff in the staff report, but I'm glad you had a chance to elucidate on it. On August 20th...
Last question.
Okay. Thank you. On August 20th, we heard about General Shelton undertaking a planning order for preparation of a follow-on operations, and obviously there were never any follow-on operations that came to fruition. But what directions did you give the military for development of military plans against bin Laden after August 20th for our guidance?
Our plans were to try to, quote, capture and capture or kill bin Laden. That was the directive that went out, the memorandum of notification. The President had signed several of those, refining them on each and every occasion. Taking that directive, we had our people in a position, should there be, quote, actionable intelligence, again, the key word, and we should discuss that and debate that issue of what constitutes it. But whenever there was, quote, actionable intelligence, we were prepared to take action to destroy bin Laden or the targets. Were there plans to use special forces to supplement the Northern Alliance if they were able to apprehend and hold on to bin Laden? The answer was yes. There were packages that were developed with our special forces at Fort Bragg. There were a number of proposals, quote, on the table or on the shelf prepared to be utilized in the event that we were certain, and not certain to 100% degree, but reasonably certain that he was going to be at a given area. I know a question's been raised, well, why wouldn't you put a unit in there with the anticipation that they could help gather intelligence and track him down? And I've tried to address this in my written statement, but consider the notion we have 13,500 troops in Afghanistan right now, not to mention the Pakistanis, and we can't find bin Laden to date. So the notion that you're going to put a small unit, however good, on the ground, or a large unit, and put them into Afghanistan and track down bin Laden, I think is folly. But if we had people on the ground, if we had the Northern Alliance, if they were reliable, did we have people prepared to go? The answer was yes. General Shelton, I think, will tell you, it's very difficult to kill an individual with a missile. We all know that. You're talking about 6 hours from the time the quote spun up. You've got the coordinates, GPS signals, target that individual. You're 6 hours away. To put troops on the ground was probably double that time. By the time you take a package and fly them from Fort Bragg or compose some elements that were already in the Gulf, you're talking more than 6 hours. So the answer is, why don't you have forces on the ground in Afghanistan? And the point I'm simply trying to make is that the notion that you could put thousands or hundreds or even tens of people on the ground and hope to locate him under those circumstances, I think, is simply unrealistic.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Kerry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Senator.
This is former Senator Bob Kerry of Nebraska, who is now the president of the new school in New York City.
Until I prepared for this hearing, realized then you reinforced it that, that you were the father of the Special Operations Command, and it must have given you a considerable amount of pride to see how effective Special Operations units were in Afghanistan, Iraq, and according to the reports today in the Hindu Kush, again, trying to run down bin Laden as we speak. And
Senator Kerry, you may recall one of the complaints that used to come from the Pentagon and the executive branch is that Congress engages in too much micromanagement. I think that was the case, and the reformation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with Goldwater Nichols of macro management, but I thought it played a very important role.
Certainly, both of those were, and they want you to micromanage when they've got something they want you to support. but let me also say with great respect, I do think that I do think that in 98 that a special operations unit with an element of surprise could have had a tremendous impact at that particular point. It's a judgment call you got to make. It's a much different situation than it is today, and I appreciate that very much. One of the problems I think that I have with this whole thing is that we were attacked on the 11th September 2001 by the same people that attacked the Cole on the 12th of October, 2000, by the same people who attempted to attack the Sullivans a few months earlier, by the same people who were responsible for multiple Millennium attacks in 1999, by the same people who attacked our embassies on the 7th of August, 1998, and now, as we understand it, by the same people who had previous attacks back through the 1990s, perhaps up to and including the World Trade Center bombing one. So it's not just that it's that we were attacked successfully by 19 men with less than $500,000 utterly. I mean, they just defeated every single defensive mechanism we had up in place. It's that this is the same group that had attacked us on many other occasions in the past. And that's why I keep coming to the question, why would we have a presidential directive in place in 1998? That said that the Department of Defense and our military was going to be used principally for a response if we were attacked in a local and state situation and to support what the Department of Justice was doing. I don't understand why the military wasn't given a priority and a primary role in the fight against not just terrorism, but the fight against Osama bin Laden. I mean, I presume you've seen the declaration of war that he released on the 23rd of February, 1998, that was very precise. Again, issued by somebody who had demonstrated not just a willingness to kill Americans, but the capacity to kill Americans. And every single time I heard the administration come up before the Intelligence Committee that I was on, trying to keep doing what you had done for years before, it was, we're going to send the FBI to investigate this stuff. And I would say, my God, I don't understand this. They killed airmen in Khobar Towers. They attacked our facilities in East Africa. They attacked our sailors on the Cole. I don't understand, and still today don't understand, why the military wasn't given a dominant role. And I wonder, if you're looking back on it today, do you think we underutilized the military during the 1990s and the war against, in this case, radical Islamists led by Osama bin Laden?
First of all, I've seen your comments about the need to declare war against al-Qaeda. We were at war with al-Qaeda. We weren't declaring it as such, and the president going to Congress saying, let's declare war against al-Qaeda. I take your point about bin Laden being very precise. He was very precise in issuing a personal fatwa against me. I was put on the list. There was a price tag. There were several attempts, which I don't have to go into details about, going after me. So I was very much aware that this was a war that had been declared against the United States, including members of the president's cabinet personally, putting us at risk as well as our military personnel. The use of the military, the only use I could have seen in terms of could we have done more against bin Laden, was really talk about putting a massive force into Afghanistan over the objection. You've heard this morning, and it's something that I had to take into account. Could we, in fact, take a much more aggressive military operation against bin Laden without the support of Pakistan or any of the neighboring countries. General Zinni's name has been surfaced on several occasions here. You know, when you recommend people to advise you, and I was the one who recommended that General Zinni be the commander of the CENTCOM, you look at their background, you look at their war records, you look at how they've conducted themselves, and you hopefully trust their judgment. General Zinni made a number of recommendations, which I took to heart because he was of the opinion that had we taken certain types of military action, it would have been, quote, ineffective, counterproductive. He was the same general who recommended that we not overreact when there was a military coup in Pakistan, saying, wait a minute, I've worked with this general. I think we may be able to persuade him to be much more supportive than he has been, than we think in the past. As a result of that kind of relationship that General Zinni had with General Musharraf and President Musharraf, later President Musharraf, we were able to help thwart attacks during the millennium. So you have to, at some point, put some judgment in the experts that you call upon to give you advice. Could I have second-guessed Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Shelton? Yes. Could I have second-guessed General Zinni? Did I have reason to, based upon my experience with them? And the answer was no. I put a lot of faith in their recommendations and their judgment, and I never found them, quote, risk-averse. They really were more mission-successful in their orientation, saying, if we do this, we're likely to succeed. If we do the following, we're likely to fail. Those were the kinds of decisions we had to make. So what could have been done? We had lethal authority. We were not, Sandy Berger said, we weren't trying to send simply a summons to bin Laden in Afghanistan. We were trying to kill him or anyone else who was there at the time. That was, you know, what they call a warning shot to the temple. We were trying to kill bin Laden and anyone there that went to that camp. Did we have the kind of information that would have allowed us to get him later? We didn't see it. It was never recommended. And I can't account for everything that you've heard, but there was never a recommendation that came to the national security team that said, we've got a good shot at getting him. Let's take military action and do it. The only other alternative would have been, could we have persuaded Pakistan, get out of the way, we're coming. We don't need your support. We're going to invade Afghanistan. I leave it to you, Senator Kerry, and to others who have served in Congress. Do you think it's reasonable that under the circumstances that any president, including President Clinton, could have gone to Congress in October of 2000 and said, these people are trying to kill us, and now, therefore, we're going to invade Afghanistan and take them out? I don't think so, but there are other members can disagree. Judgment call. You sat on the other side of the of that decision.
Well, that presumes that the president would come to Congress and request an authorization for action there. As you know, there have been many moments when the president doesn't request such authorization, just does it.
Can I make, one other point? One other point. You remember Kosovo.
Yeah.
Here we had a campaign going on in Kosovo. I don't know how many times you came to the White House, but there were meetings after meetings with members of Congress coming down to the president saying, it's a bad idea. When are you going to get out? What's the exit strategy? How much is it going to cost us? We had to sustain a 78-day bombing campaign, frankly, without the support of Congress. And it was a successful campaign. And as a result of that, we saved a lot of lives. But I give you that as an example to say the notion that somehow President Clinton or even President Bush, absent 9/11, could have walked into the halls of Congress, say, declare war against al-Qaeda, I think is unrealistic.
Mr. Secretary, I say you're making my argument. I supported what the president did in Kosovo. I supported what he did in Bosnia. I was in the minority in both both times. But that didn't stop him from doing it.
But he
it
had
didn't the fact that it was difficult, the fact that it was hard, the fact even that at times it was unpopular, he believed in it and he rallied the American people to the cause.
He also rallied allies.
Didn't do that with bin Laden.
But he also rallied allies to the cause. You had the NATO countries involved in Bosnia and Kosovo. You have, after 9/11, you have him rallying the international community to help go into Afghanistan. Prior to that time, I dare say there is not a single country that would have been supporting the President of the United States declaring war and invading Afghanistan prior to 9/11. You can disagree with that judgment. I don't think there would be a single country, and I frankly think that Congress would have overwhelmingly rejected it.
I would disagree. I respectfully disagree. First of all, again, as I said, there are many instances where the president doesn't even come to Congress. I mean, Operation Just Cause in Panama, he didn't come to Congress and say, gee, is it okay to do that? Grenada, the president didn't come to Congress and say, is that okay to do it? And Bosnia and Kosovo, the very examples that you cite, the president didn't have the support of Congress, and he went ahead and did it. I think he did the right thing. But the fact that it's unpopular, that it's difficult, that our allies are not necessarily with it, shouldn't deter a president who believes that what we have is a serial killer on our hands, who had begun killing us at least as early as 1993, who had issued a very specific declaration of war calling Islamic men to join an Islamic army on the 23rd of February 1998, and then demonstrated that he had the capacity in a very sophisticated way on the 7th of August to carry out that threat. And what did we... I mean, we did not. We had a round in our chamber, and we didn't use it. That's how I see it. And I don't know if it had prevented 9/11, but I absolutely do not believe that just because the commander in chief sits there and said, gee, this thing's unpopular, therefore I can't do it, I don't think that's a good argument.
Senator Kerry, let me.
I know Secretary Rumsfeld is going to use it here in a few minutes, and I'm going to be just as harsh with him. I don't buy it.
Well, Senator Kerry, let's go back. Let's go back to the Persian Gulf War, 91.
Yeah.
There you had Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait. There you had the President of the United States, President Bush, 41, going to the international community, gathering support, and then deciding to come to the Congress to get congressional support. Close call. You had, I think it passed the Senate by 4 votes under those extraordinary circumstances. But I would submit to you the notion that you would be able, in the fall of 2000, to have rallied the Congress and the country to invade Afghanistan and to have had the support of Pakistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, all of the other people in the region, I don't think is realistic. Judgment call, we can be faulted for that. I just don't think it was feasible.
Well, I just say for the record, better have tried and failed than not to try at all. And I think in this particular case, what you've got, the thing that's most troubling about 9/11 is that it was carried out by the same group of people that had killed Americans the previous October, that had tried to kill Americans on the Sullivans just before that in the summer of 2000. It's a serial series of events stretching back for a decade.
And that's the problem, with
a declaration of war by the guy who's leading the organization.
And we were trying to kill those members whenever we could find them. But you're not talking about people sitting in a city waiting to be attacked. It's like mercury on a mirror. You're talking about individuals who can't hide. I mean, let's look at what's taking place today. I point out again, you've got thousands of people on the ground in Afghanistan with the support of Pakistan, and we still are unable to track him down and to kill him.
But if you look at the performance of the special operations units in northern Afghanistan and the war against Afghanistan, and they leveraged thousands of GI's effort, they were enormously effective.
I agree.
Likewise in Iraq, and likewise again right now in Afghanistan.
I agree. I think we owe them a tremendous amount of gratitude for all of the sacrifice they make and the training they have. That's the reason we are the finest in the world, because of that training.
What was the military objective on 20 August 1998?
The military objective was to kill as many people in those camps as we could, to take out the pharmaceutical plant because we had reason to believe, actionable intelligence.
But there were more men south of Kandahar than there was up by coast. Why did we attack that particular camp?
Because the intelligence was that we believed that bin Laden and his associates were going to be there. We went after as many as we could and as high as we could. We didn't know whether he'd be there for sure. We hoped he would be there. He slipped away, apparently.
Did you consider putting a special ops team, a relatively small special ops team, just to get eyes on the prize, just to be able to be sort of forward air controllers to tell, rather than having to rely on satellites or tribals to tell you where bin Laden was?
I think that the judgment was that it was a more discreet operation, likely to be less compromised than if we tried to put people on the ground at that time. Again, you can question that judgment, but that was a recommendation coming that had the best chance of success of getting him.
We're going to hear from Secretary Rumsfeld in a little bit, and I want to ask you one last question in that regard. During the transition, you briefed the Secretary on 50 items and also briefed him on al-Qaeda, and perhaps he's going to recall it, but in a previous interview, he didn't remember much about the briefing on al-Qaeda. Can you offer any reasons why?
I listed, since I had limited time with Secretary Rumsfeld, I knew that he had, was quite familiar with the office, and what I tried to do is to give him the whole panoply in a very short period of time, knowing that there were going to be specific briefings on by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and others, Joint Staff, the National Security Advisor, and also the CIA. So we tried to cover as many subjects as we could. The very first subject had to do with a major threat to the United States involving al-Qaeda or bin Laden's associates, but an extremist group launching an attack domestically. I don't think I want to talk about it any more than that, but that was a number one item. Everything else on the item were issues that I thought he should at least be aware of, but number one was my concern. And frankly, I came to Capitol Hill. I met, I think, with just a total of perhaps 8 to 10 people to talk about the threat that existed and what needed to be done to help counter it. But I don't think I want
to
talk about
it. Let me say in conclusion, Mr. Secretary, as I said at the beginning, Goldwater Nichols Special Operations Command, the men and women of the Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard that won the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, that was your that was your troops, and you ought to be, feel very proud of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator.
Governor Thompson.
This is Governor James Thompson, Republican, former governor of Illinois. Straight.
We've been talking for the last half hour on the issue of response to the USS Cole. Mm-hmm. If I understand the testimony of a lot of people, the Clinton administration didn't believe it had proof sufficient of al-Qaeda's responsibility before they left office, and perhaps the Bush administration felt it wasn't on their watch and they had other fish to fry. And passing that, you seem to suggest in your answer to an earlier question that the only option for a military reprisal for the bombing of the Cole was an invasion of Afghanistan. And I think most people would agree, and certainly prior testimony has cited, that that was just not an appropriate response. We had no place to forward base from. We had no coalition. It was much different than Kosovo, where we had overflight rights and we had allies. But am I wrong in believing that just as appropriate a response would have been action against the Taliban, not necessarily just against Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda followers? We knew where Mullah Omar lived, presumably. What about a missile strike on Taliban facilities, not just their training camps, but on their civil seats of government? There would have been collateral damage, yes, but I think you said you were willing to accept collateral damage, and the 13 sailors we lost in the Cole were not collateral damage, they were direct damage. Was any consideration given to reprisals against the institutions and facilities, civil government of the Taliban for the Cole?
There were a number of proposals, and I can't recall specifically, but I think Mr. Clark may be talking about those tomorrow, but there were a number of recommendations to go in and flatten a number of areas. During that time, we did not have specific information. This was bin Laden. Frankly, that was my suspicion. It could have been other Islamic extremists that were operating out of Yemen. We knew, we found out in retrospect, there had been a previous attack that was unsuccessful against the Sullivan. But that was my suspicion. We were trying to get bin Laden in any event. Whether it was before the Cole or after the Cole, we were still looking for ways in which we might attack bin Laden. So there were some recommendations to actually just flatten a number of areas. It was the considered judgment at the time that that would not have either gotten bin Laden or have resulted in a positive reaction by either Pakistan, that we were courting at that point to try and persuade them to join us in this effort, or any of the others in the region. So it was determined, again, that it would have been not been effective and it might have been counterproductive. That was a judgment call at the time. As the Secretary of Defense, I have to make recommendations to the President. I have to do so certainly filled with passion in terms of what had happened to the Cole I went to those funerals and services, and I met with all the families, and so it was pretty important to me that I had to also take into account what would have been the impact of launching an attack against the Taliban at that point when we didn't have the support of Pakistan, who was officially still supporting the Taliban. Would that have been counterproductive and less effective? Our judgment was that it would not have been effective, and we didn't do it.
Do you think it's appropriate to assert, as some people have, that one of the first acts of a brand new national administration, in this case the Bush administration, would have been to go to war over the coal?
No. I think the first act of the administration is to assess all of the information it can, to make an informed judgment, to take actions, not only one action, but to see what are the consequences of that action. I don't think any administration should take a precipitous action. They should look at the facts and then make a determination. What are the consequences of this? What is the follow-up? If we take action to attack the Taliban, how much will it take? How many forces will we – all of these factors have to be taken into account. And I think you never take step one without asking yourself, what's step five and six? Where are we? And so, no, I don't fault the administration for not doing that immediately.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Gorelick.
Mr. Secretary, this is Jamie Gorelick, who served in the Clinton administration as Deputy Attorney General.
As always, very thoughtful and broad-gauged. I have been troubled about something that perhaps you can help on. You were in these meetings where the various possibilities of getting Osama bin Laden were discussed. We now have huge and selective leaks coming from various levels of the CIA who were saying, we really had him, we had great intelligence, we could have gotten him, and the policymakers overruled us. But at the same time, you have Sandy Berger and I think yourself and others saying, no, the director of CIA told us the intelligence was not good enough and he was not recommending going forward. And that leaves us in a very peculiar position. Either the people below George Tenet didn't know what was happening above his level or at his level, or he was telling them one thing and telling you another, or maybe there's some third possibility. But this is an important issue for us to understand. Did we have it? Did we not have it? Was it good? Was it not good? And how could there be this dispute on something so fundamental? And I would just like your view on this.
There are 23,000 people who work at the Pentagon. Secretary Lehman probably knows from his own experience how disconcerting that can be in terms of trying to maintain control and to maintain the flow of information coming up through the Department of the Navy or the Department of Defense. There were 3,000 people on the Office of Secretary of Defense staff that we tried to reduce by a third. That was one of my goals in taking the office itself, but 2,000 people in the Office of Secretary of Defense. I can assure you there are people inside the Pentagon who say, if only